Good day, and welcome to episode 9 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. This week we're joined by a panel of Guelph students for a discussion entitled High School and Post-Secondary Education in the Time of COVID, a Student Perspective. The talk this week is moderated by second-year McGill University student Sequoia Kim, a Breezy Breakfast regular contributor, and she's joined by first-year University of Toronto student Audney Cachet Stewart, and Sequoia's younger sister Indigo, who's in her final year of high school here in Guelph. At our August 13, 2020 Breezy Online Breakfast meeting, Sequoia prefaced the talk by stating that at the start of the pandemic in March, high school and university administrators ushered classes online in a matter of weeks. Over the summer, universities and high schools across the country have been actively planning a full or partial transition to online learning. Today we'll discuss experiences with that learning and we'll share our concerns, excitements, and thoughts going into the 2020 fall semester. It's a very timely discussion. We'll also hear from Hina Mistry, another valued member of the Breezy Bunch, who is just finishing a contract as an adjunct professor at Queen's University, with her perspective from that side of things. We start with Sequoia, whose name is the only one I can think of that uses every vowel.
Okay, so thank you all for coming today. So today's topic, if you weren't aware, is about COVID's changes and how that might look on post-secondary and high school. And we have myself, I'm Sequoia Kim. I'm going into my second year at McGill University and I'm studying poli-sci and philosophy. And joined with me today is a good friend and powerful human being, Audney Cachet Stewart. I think that's how you pronounce your last name. Audney, if you want to introduce yourself real quick, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, that's how you pronounce it.
Okay.
Thank you so much for having me here bright and early. Yes, my name is Audney Cachet. I went to school with Sequoia. I'll be going to University of Toronto in the fall for humanities. Do I expand on who I am?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so I've been involved with activism since elementary school. My friend Carly and I started the Black Student Union and Alliance at GCBI. We host and organize different events such as Black History Month assemblies. We recently had author Lauryn Hill come to GC. We were also able to go to Toronto and mentor younger students. I've been a youth leader. I currently work with different organizations such as Black Women in Motion, and I have my own podcast, and I recently started my own business. So that's a little bit about me.
That is so amazing. Girl, so cool. You are such a revolutionary person. Okay, I'm so glad to have you on the panel today. This is awesome. Yeah, so we didn't have any pre-submitted questions, but I'm gonna ask some kind of prompts that we're both gonna answer. And I think that will definitely spur some discussion and keep things on track. And it'll be a really interesting discussion. I want to say thank you so much for centering student voices today. I think it's really important to get, I guess I just would like to start off with both of us just saying a quick introduction about what some of our thoughts were on online learning. And I guess like what happened in March, like what kind of was going through our minds in that initial kind of pandemic announcement and the quick shift to online learning in March. Audney, if you want to start, you can go ahead. I'll go after.
Yeah. When everything happened, it was so sudden. For me personally, during the time in March, that's when you're hearing back from universities, you're trying to get your midterms up, your grades in, and when everything happened, the province was not communicating very well with the students. The teachers were not aware of what was happening. And during a pandemic, when people are literally dying and getting sick, we have to sit down at a computer for 7 hours to try to concentrate on trying to, you know, further our education. But what was really upsetting is that I just saw in the chat that this, again, does impact marginalized kids, impact those who do not have stable households, who don't have electronics that work fast. You know, it's very privileged to know that we are able to sit down here and even have a Zoom meeting while there are kids who don't have access to Wi-Fi, who don't have the support, who have learning disabilities, who that cannot be conveyed well with online learning. So this transition is very hard, especially those who are in rural areas. I know recently that where my house is located, I live in Erin, but some people that live like a kilometer down the street don't have good working Wi-Fi. So there's so many issues and again, uncertainty with online learning, which really takes me aback and really is discouraging to even go into post-secondary as a result of how this, I'm not gonna get the same learning experience sitting down and attending the one of the best universities, you know? Like, I'm spending thousands and thousands of dollars to sit on my MacBook.
Yep.
Period. Like, why am I spending thousands? That's why many people don't even want to go to post-secondary, did not sign up for post-secondary this coming semester. And we don't even know if maybe, like COVID dies down. It's not going to, like, that's just a hypothetical. And now people are saying, oh, I missed out, or if it increases again. It's just the times where we need a lot more guidance and a lot more help from our leaders and from our political leaders. And I know they don't have the answers, but it's a time where we are going to either be losing money, losing family and friends, losing so many things that are going to really impact our well-being and our mental health, which cannot really be solved online all the time. We need that one-on-one time with people and to go into classes, but we can't go into classes because it's in the middle of a pandemic. So I'm just overwhelmed with just thinking about all these things. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that, Adni. That's, I feel like I wanted, I think this conversation is really interesting because it would be good to talk both personally, like what did I experience? Like what are my peers thinking? What's going through our heads? And also extending the conversation to like a broader conversation about equity, about accessibility and stuff. So thank you for starting us off on that note. I guess I'll just give you a quick, my thought process in March. So I was in my 600 person class.
Ironically, since Adni had just finished talking about the problems with online learning around Wi-Fi signal, especially in rural areas, Sequoia at this point lost touch. And our friend Hina came to the rescue by asking a question until Sequoia got herself back in a place where she could fit into our Zoom meeting.
I had asked Adni and Sequoia, are you continuing with your studies online this fall? Or are you going to be taking a pause? So what are your plans for the next for the upcoming semester?
Yeah, so I will be continuing with online learning. I kind of wanted to take a year off, but that wasn't an option for me. So I will be continuing with my studies, and I wish, honestly, that I could take the year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Is it good?
That's clear.
Okay, good. I moved to a different room.
I don't know if you also wanted to answer this question, but Susan had asked, ask you both, are you continuing your studies online this fall, or are you going to be taking a pause? So basically, what are your plans for the upcoming semester?
Yes. Okay. I am going back to Montreal and I'm sticking with the online, but I'll expand on that in a second. But great questions. Very interesting to know. Anyway, so I'm just going to continue where I left off. So I was in a, get this, 600 person class. That's like our biggest class at McGill, taking intro level poli-sci course. And then that night, that university emailed us that they were closing the university for 2 days because there was this strange new virus going around and everyone was like freaking out. And some people moved out of the residence that like week. And so then things like started to pretty much like people moved out within a week, 2 weeks of hearing the announcement, and kind of things were up in the air. And so that was a huge disruption, especially with so many international students. McGill has around 46% of its student body international students. So people were deciding, are my borders going to close? Should I stay here? What will happen? What's, you know, will the semester be continued online? So there's kind of just same thing as Audney touched on. There just wasn't a ton of communication because no one knew. No one knew what was going on. So, a lot of fear, a lot of profs being stressed out, a lot of last minute, like, holy crap, we missed a week of university lectures, which is a lot of content considering that our semester is much smaller. So there was a lot of like, how is everything going to work? But I can get into the details of stuff later. So I actually ended up coming home and I guess I finished the last 2 weeks of school and exams online from my bedroom. So that was a really interesting little taste. I think things will be different because people have had longer to plan stuff. The exams were, for me, very essay heavy. Some were 3 hours, some were 24, some were 48 hours, some were 72 hours. So they kind of had blocked off times to do stuff. So that was an interesting format, especially for people who are used to, especially for everyone who is used to going into the exam room and sitting down for 3 hours exactly, and then writing their exam in super stressful, like down to the very last minute. So that was kind of a nice break. So honestly, it was, I'm very like privileged to say that I found the second half of the semester much easier because just so many things were, people were trying to make it so much more accessible for people. For me, I had a stable internet access, you know, like the exam format worked out really well for me, but I've had some very important conversations with people and I guess I work at the newspaper too at my school, so I've written a few articles about this, and it's definitely exposed some inequities. And then we can get into that in a second, actually, because I think that's a super important thing to talk about. But before we do that, I'm just wondering, Audney, if you wanted to touch on what your school has announced, like has U of T said anything about how things will work? And I guess, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, so U of T, they sent an email saying that you can do hybrid or just online. So my first semester is online, but my second semester is quote unquote in person, which I don't believe that's gonna happen, but you know, they're doing their thing. I think University of Toronto was one of the first ones to really respond to it, but I don't trust it, honestly.
Yeah. So same, I guess I'll just quickly touch on McGill. So, I mean, McGill has been super, really, really good at giving us coronavirus and COVID-19 updates. They would send one every week. But I mean, as of now, I still don't know what my semester is going to look like, which is a little frustrating. They guaranteed pretty early on that all courses and classes would be delivered remotely online. So you could do the entire semester from any country in the world as long as you have an internet access and a laptop, and you would be fine. So they guaranteed that for international students, which is really nice. Yeah, but I still don't know exactly how, you know, how exactly classes are going to go. I know that residences will be open for students. Frosh will be online. That'll be very interesting. University buildings are being opened gradually over the summer, which I think is a good approach. Yeah, and I mean, currently Montreal cases are hovering around 20 to 30 a day, which is very bad. And Guelph is 7 or so, but I mean, Guelph is like definitely settling down, but that does not mean that we need to be less stringent about it. And yeah, that's pretty much it. I do wish that administrations, I mean, they're in a very tight spot because they just really don't know stuff, you know. It's really hard to come up with stuff on the fly, but yeah, I wish that there would be a little more communication with the students, as Audie mentioned. And then I'm just going to turn it over to Indy for a quick second to speak about GCVI's plans and high school, because I think both of us are a little out of the loop having transitioned to the post-secondary system. So Indy, if you wanted to talk about GCVI and Guelph high schools and if they've announced anything.
Sure. Can everyone hear me all right? Okay. So I'm a GC student. I'm going into grade 12 this year. So I'm in the cohort who would be applying to university this year. I'll touch on that later. So next year for GCVI, they have put forward a plan that basically is planning to get students back in schools and in face-to-face learning, but can also give parents the option of keeping their kids home if they don't feel comfortable with that. So you kind of have the option to do synchronous learning at home, which is as close as they have tried to get it to in-person learning online, or go to school and do a quadmester. So basically separating you into two cohorts throughout the day. So you'd be taking two courses at a time for one quadmester. And so you do four quadmesters throughout the year. So it's a different format completely. I don't think anyone is really sure how it's going to work. I know Juanita was mentioning in the chat about the social aspect of university, and not that we really have much of a choice in high school, but I've heard some worries around some of my friends about losing some of that social aspect, because you can't really hang out with other people at lunch, and you're with your set classes, your two classes throughout the day. So that's kind of the two options that you have, so online or in school. And then just another thing that I thought was interesting from my perspective as someone who's applying to university this year, I've talked to a couple of my peers who are planning to go to university, who have decided to take a gap year instead and apply next year or the year after that. So I don't know the scale of this or what rippling effect it will have, but that's what some Sequoia and Ani have touched on about losing that first year or student or university experience. And I know some people who are deciding to not apply to university this year. So, Andy, that is actually happening. And I don't know whether that will result in a bigger pool of applications in years to come or what the effects of that will be. But it's definitely a fear that people have going into university and something that people are just realizing that they have to deal with in high school at this point.
Yeah, to quickly like touch on that. Mm-hmm. Sorry to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. So I was actually set on going to Ottawa in the fall. I got my scholarship from Carleton. I was like, okay, I was supposed to double major in communications and human rights and social justice. And then when everything happened, I was just like, okay, am I still going? Again, with the uncertainty. And I really didn't want to go to U of T, but the campus which I applied to was Mississauga. And I'm only 40 minutes away. So that's when I was like, okay, I don't know what's happening in the fall. So it's better if I just stay home and save some money at least. So I feel like there's an effect on how universities are not just getting international students, but like students who are far away.
Yeah. You know, I feel like we should stay on this point and talk about the potential downsides and I guess struggles that students like might face in terms of either social life, in terms of learning, accessibility, adjusting, and all that kind of thing. Because I mean, there's definitely a lot of concerns hovering around the transition to online learning, especially I couldn't imagine as someone who's going into first year university, that must be so stressful for you, because my first year was very stressful for me and it was completely normal year. So, I mean, if you wanted to touch on like some of your thoughts going in, that would be great. I just wanted to say a few things about some concerns that I've heard from students kind of just floating around since this all started and continuing on over the summer. So the first thing is, what about science and music students and visual arts students and anyone who kind of has a more interactive hands-on, you know, their program depends on in-person or in-nature activities. So a lot of those people are saying, hey, like part of my degree, like part of the reason I signed up to do this program, you know, is to have these experiences that I wouldn't otherwise have, that I'm paying to get access to these resources, like practice rooms, like labs, because science students, like labs occupy many, many, many hours of their week, and it's very hands-on, and it allows you to kind of transition from what you learned in class in a huge lecture hall to actual work. So, I mean, I know a lot of science students are very upset about that. Also visual arts majors, of course, who just don't have a studio to go to. So, you know, I have spoken with the Dean of Sciences about this, and he assured me that everything was going to be great and fine. And I have also spoken to science students and engineering students at University of Waterloo who are like, online labs are horrible and we hate them. So we'll need to see how that develops and how that works out, but I'm concerned for that. Another thing that a lot of my friends are very concerned about is border issues and visas and getting them on time, because one of my friends is from Spain and couldn't get a visa in time to come back, but was planning on it and has an apartment and a lease in Montreal, so is kind of having to deal with that. And a lot of people, you know, can't come back, or you know, visas are late, borders are closed to some people, so that's a big concern. International students can only work 20 hours a week too. So I would say that's another big issue. I'm gonna fire these off because I just want to get some of these points into the discussion, is mental health and mental health supports. So I'm sure others can attest to this, but I'm, you know, like Audney mentioned, looking at your screen like all day, not being forced to leave your house to go to a class, staying home, being encouraged to not leave and not go outside can be difficult. If you are an entering first year student or a shy person or just any person in university, your social life is going to be different for sure. Especially if you're choosing not to come back to campus. So that can really do something to your mental health too. And also no in-person study groups. So, I mean, that's a huge part of my learning, right? It's like we'd book a room and we'd all, you know, stay up. We'd like order pizza and like quiz each other. And it was like super fun. And I learned so much than just kind of rereading my notes. So that was kind of a big part of university. And actually, I learned the most when I was just talking with my friends. Same with networking, all the clubs, like, you know, like you kind of, that's how you get experience when you're a student. Also, learning from abroad can be very difficult. Family situations, if you have like 8 people in your family, or if home is not a safe space for you, or if you just aren't as productive at home. Internet access, of course, is a huge one. Computer access too. Time zone considerations. If you have to wake up at 3 a.m. for a class, that sucks. And also no access to the library too. That's a small concern. Support from TAs and professors. I mean, there was actually a great question about this in the chat, so I'll ask that later about TAs and professors. Yeah, and also just concerns about crashes, internet, you know, worries, bugs, stuff like that. And I guess also study habits sometimes can be a little more difficult. Anyway, sorry, that was my biggest chunk. I just wanted to make sure that lots of perspectives were included. Yeah, I guess I feel like you kind of answered this already. Yeah, okay, so I'm just gonna ask, so Hina just sent me some questions in the chat. Okay, Phil asked a question. I feel like we kind of answered some of the ones above. Is it an honest concern that teachers doing video conferences should feel threatened by students who might film, edit, and present teachers and teaching in a negative light? Do students have examples of this from their own experiences? Is it a myth? Is it a privacy concern as teachers? I don't know if you guys want to touch on this at all. I'm not really sure because we haven't experienced it yet. But Audney, do you have anything you might want to say to that?
Yeah, is it a privacy concern for the teachers or is it a privacy concern for the students? You
both,
know,
both actually.
Yeah,
exactly. I would say that there should be proper penalty in place if that were to happen to a teacher. However, students being online, and there's already been cases of sexual misconduct in Wellington Catholic District School Board and many other universities. So we don't know how anybody is really going to react in this way and how they will react inappropriately. Yet again, it's both, but I don't think we should limit that to teachers.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, okay, actually it's kind of an interesting question. What would we do if we were in charge? It's kind of hard to know because I'm missing on some of the data and, you know, I can't know everything, but do you have any kind of like visionary ideas about like what would be ideal for you as a student or what you think would be a good way to do this?
Vision, this is too early to think about visions. I'm kidding.
I feel you,
but
it's hard.
Right. If honestly, if I could be in charge of the world, I would say Corona bye. But if I were to just be a leader in this society, especially in this climate, I would just want to be a support system for the students. Especially right now, I'm very scared and fearful to go into first year because I did not have the proper one-on-one time with my high school students. I would say that I'm ill-prepared for university. I'm scared to fail. I'm scared of that outcome. I don't know how anything's really going to work. Mm-hmm. And so I really wish there was more support from the high school teachers for the graduating class of 2020. For their transition into post-secondary. Just to be a support for the students would be my greatest hope.
Yeah, as a follow-up, you're going into your first year, big transition. What are you most excited for? What are you dreading? What do you expect, or like what would you want as a support system as a first year who has no idea how university works?
Yeah, what I would want ideally would to have nice professors, but I know that's probably not gonna happen. I took an effective writing class because I want to improve on my writing. I know that there's a really big shift in essays and essay format into university, so I really want support with how to improve and not to fail. Like, my GPA needs to look good, but that would be what I'm really dreading. I'm excited to learn again. I'm excited to further my learning and stuff that I'm passionate about. I took a lot of really interesting courses in the semester coming up. So yeah, did that answer?
Yeah, I have one more question. What course are you most looking forward to? It's kind of a side thing.
Ooh, okay, let me think about them. I'm taking ideas and ideologies, so that's like a
policy. Oh my god. Nice.
Women and gender, astronomy, astronomy, and probably crim. I think I'm most excited for effective writing, crim, or my poli-sci courses.
That sounds awesome. So cool. Okay, that's totally fair about what you said going in about, and also support system, that's like so true. We need to care for everyone and make sure that no one's left behind. I wanted to talk quickly about international students and tuition fees. These two things are definitely a big part of the conversation. I'm sorry if this is not relevant to you guys. I'll try and be really fast. So tuition rates at McGill for international students range from $20,000 to $50,000 a year, depending on your program. If that's crazy to you, welcome to our generation. Tuition fees are skyrocketing, and a lot of the burden, especially in Quebec, is placed on international students because our tuition is deregulated for international students, which means they can just change it however they want. International students carry most of the brunt. They basically fund our university. Considering that tuition for Quebecers costs like $5,000 or $6,000 a year, big difference there. Tuition for out of province costs roughly $10,000. Anyways, so there's definitely been some debates over tuition and also about university funding in general. I've heard that tuition fees at Guelph are being hiked. I'm not sure if that got resolved. As you can see, it's a trend. University administrations are realizing that they're either going to be super in debt or that they need to raise tuition fees, or like basically just trying to answer the question, how do we pay for all this? And so it sounds like it's going to be more expensive to go online. I could see how that's true. You probably need tons of IT support, extra support in transition. You know, like we could have a whole conversation about that. But it's just like, how is this affecting the students? So, I know a lot of people are, I know a lot of from the administration perspective, a lot of university administrations, are kind of like, we need to sustain the long-term like future of our institutions. So we don't really care about you personally, like, sorry, you're just, you know, because at a very cynical level, universities are big money-making machines, especially the big ones like U of T, McGill, UBC. So a lot of students are calling for tuition to be reduced a little bit, especially students who are really affected. So that'll be an interesting thing. I don't think that's going to happen just because administrations are so powerful. And I had written out this whole debate and all the little details of tuition, but I don't know if it's super relevant. But I will say that I saw this article, Canadian Association of Teachers and Federation of Students, blah, 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 said 1 in 2 students said COVID-19 has made it more difficult to afford tuition and living costs. That is not a surprise. And I just hope that universities are really pitching in to support people financially and also academically, socially, mentally, you know, in all these different ways. McGill has currently pulled together $1 million for students, and we have 40,000, and Guelph has $4 million for 30,000 students. So I hope that McGill pulls up its socks a little bit. I think that financial support is going to be super important moving forward, especially for international students and also for like really for anyone. I just hope that tuition isn't like hiked too much, because there's a lot of people who depend on scholarships, on loans to stay in their program. So they can't really drop out. They can't really defer because those loans like lock them into their program. So that'll be a really interesting discussion. If you guys have more questions about that, that's great. You can ask away. And then sort of moving into another question about broader impacts to post-secondary, or are there any positive upsides, or what do we think how will the education system be spit out on the flip side in, you know, a few years after COVID, if COVID ever dies down, you know, what will be some like changes, whether positive or negative? Audney, if you want to speak to that.
Is this for post-secondary or secondary just in the...
You know what? Either one.
I feel like positives that could really come out of this would be that, well, for me at least, a positive when everything happened, when the world shut down, was that I could breathe. That a lot of times we're so caught up as students, as, you know, working people, that we don't really have time for ourselves. So I really think that this COVID-19 has really allowed people to balance that work experience and our personal lives to an extent, because we are home. A lot of people get to spend time with their families and such. In the education system, I feel like this is a time where, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement, school bodies were able to sit down and be like, oh, I finally have to do something. I finally have to have more representation for the BIPOC students. So this is a positive that's going to come out of it, because mm-hmm. I feel like now they have more time to integrate this into their curriculums, to highlight the pandemic of racism, honestly. So that is a big positive. Another thing with tuition fees, like you were speaking on, universities already was built off capitalism and they are inequitable for a lot of marginalized communities. So I feel like we're really gonna see how students of color don't really want to go to university anymore, and how that will be a great decline, especially those who rely on loans and OSAP. And the next, what is going to be accessible, is OSAP going to decrease even more from our present leadership? So again, it's really gonna focus on our money, how we see things, and what really happens in our social climate moving forward for this to have a positive or a negative effect on our education system.
Thanks for that, Audney. That was a very comprehensive answer, and I would like to branch off on a few things you said. First of all, concerning student activism, a lot of student activism that I was aware of and that I saw happening was direct action on campus activism. And I was thinking like, oh crap, there's, you know, like sitting in at a admin meeting for divesting is like more powerful than, I don't know, Zoom bombing a meeting or something. You know, it's a lot of those things just are so much more powerful as direct action in-person things. So I'm a little worried about student accountability for administration's bad actions, you know, because a lot of the time it's basically students versus administration. We're always fighting about things to do. We want them to divest. We want them to actually care about students. We want them to provide us with supports, you know, stuff like that. And I'm worried that there's going to be less accountability because you can't show up on campus and deal with it. So I'm kind of worried about decisions being made behind closed doors, but I don't know. So I guess that's kind of a current problem. Also about accessibility, I think that the conversation could go either way. You could say that it's actually more accessible because people can choose when to do work. People who have physical disabilities sometimes have trouble getting onto campus and attending lectures. And so a lot of this can be done remotely and can be done where people are comfortable. But also, this also goes for people with like very extreme social anxiety. I knew people who didn't go to classes because it was just too overwhelming. So I think that could go either way, but there's also, of course, the downsides that we talked about. Also, professors may put more effort into their classes, I would hope, especially considering that this is like going to be challenging for a lot of students. So I hope that some professors realize that. I know some professors who are just really inconsiderate and just are kind of too stuck up to care about certain, you know, students outside their own lived experience. So I hope that they really actually think intersectionally about students and care about them. And I guess like on a more macro level, talking about university funding, like Audney mentioned, like I also read this article about how post-secondary education institutions, their funding has always been the first in the chopping block. They, like when austerity measures come in after 2008, tuition, I guess post-secondary funding was cut. In Quebec, that meant, you know, it really, really raising tuition rates, especially in international students, which led to a ton of student debt. Others just kind of suffered the debt, I guess. And so I hope that maybe a bigger conversation about university funding and supports for students and scholarships, because I know some of the universities like Carleton, when I applied, like they have such an amazing scholarship program that if those incentives were really available and accessible to students, like we might see more students who wouldn't have ever dreamed of being able to afford university to see their dreams realized. So I hope that this leads to kind of a broader discussion. Yeah, I guess also just maybe the curriculum will change. Maybe we'll have, like, because I'm sure the world will change. The job market will change after COVID. This is going to be an event that people are talking about for decades. It's definitely going to define my lifetime. It's going to define my job prospects. People are going to act differently. Things are going to work differently. So I hope that the university system really adjusts to that future and recognizes that new skills will have to be learned. Kind of like seeing those macro changes too. I wonder if that will be a good thing or not. I don't know if really transitioning to more online is like a super good thing. We could talk about that. Yeah, okay, so that's pretty much my part there. I'm gonna hand it over to Hina for a second to speak about disability and online learning issues and accessibility issues. So Hina, if you wanted to say something on that, go ahead.
Yeah, so I just wanted to raise some things that like people might not realize when it comes to like accessibility and online learning. So again, like I was faculty at Queen's when the lockdown happened. I was like teaching as an adjunct in the history department. And one of the issues that came up was, you know, yes, it becomes more accessible in terms of like physical disabilities and that you don't have to now move, you know, to a classroom which might not have, you know, an accessible entranceway or, you know, like accessible seating or all those things. Like it might, those like sort of the physical accessibility concerns, like, yeah, some of them went away when it came to online mm-hmm. learning, but the problem is like that doesn't, online learning also doesn't necessarily account for things like hearing disabilities or like vision disabilities, right? Because if you, and that was especially like the problem when in the US, like a lot of universities went on to online learning and they'd have things like Zoom lectures and Zoom classrooms. But if you have a hearing disability, you can't learn that way because, you know, you'd need something that's captioned, you know, like a transcript of something, like you wouldn't actually be able to be participating, and then that would exclude you in addition to all the things that come with sort of like you know, like internet access and all those things. So one of the things that and I've been speaking with the accessibility coordinator at Queen's, Andrew Ashby, and he was really helpful actually in informing me about this, but yeah, like the one of the things that a lot of professors have been instructed to do was basically to, you know, not actually have synchronous learning forms. Like you'd have to actually either write out a transcript of your lecture or record it and have captions so that everybody, like no one is sort of excluded in that sense when it comes to online learning. But yeah, I just wanted to say that, like sometimes we think, oh, we just assume sometimes like, oh, online learning means it's accessible, but that's not actually the case a lot of the times, because even with things like that are like digital learning materials, it's like, if you can't run that through like a, like the software that helps you like read it, if you are like visually impaired, then you can't, you're also like sort of excluded from the classroom. So there's so many, like there's so many different concerns that come up when in terms of like accessibility and online learning. So thanks.
Definitely. That's, yeah, that, thank you so much for that, Hina. Yeah. So I really hope that universities implement and think about like all students' needs, because sure, if you can guarantee remote learning, that's awesome for, you know, for people, but it's like, it doesn't make a difference if you're doing it remotely and you can't like actually access the material. So, yeah, that'll be a really, important thing to consider moving forward. Are there any questions that I really missed in chat? Hina, are there any that are jumping out at you that you think that we should cover?
Okay. So Phil had a question. I have heard that academic honesty is a threat from Mac education. I've heard that students collaborate on everything, including work that's intended to be done individually. Are there any comments about this from the students?
Students are going to try to do whatever they were doing in the classrooms. Y'all can't say that is just online. So I don't know really how that's going to play out, how people are going to react, or what policies the universities will have to implement as a result to online learning. So that is something that we're just going to have to learn and like see, in my opinion.
Yeah. I don't really know if this is much different from in-person learning. You're always going to have cheats. You're always going to have people who sideline stuff. You know, there's like, the internet is a thing. What are you going to do about it? You know, you'd hope, I mean, okay, the consequences for academic dishonesty, like plagiarism and stuff, are quite severe. So I was like, not going to do that. But, you know, I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong about working on an essay together, as long as you're not submitting the same one. I think that, I mean, for me, that was a huge part of my learning, was like collaborating with people, and not in a way where I was stealing their ideas or was like, you know, heavily leaning on them. Like, I don't think that's dishonest, but yeah, I don't know. I don't really know if going online will change anything. In fact, it might even make it harder because people like are just not seeing each other too much. But I mean, I do kind of feel for professors who normally do in-person midterms and exams and now have to administer them online, where people can take screenshots, people can cheat, I guess. So like, I don't know what the formats will be. Professors are often pretty sneaky and actually pretty clever at coming up with exams where you can't really cheat, because you just have to put work in. For example, writing essays, you know, like, you can have an open book and you can still get a C+. So yeah, it'll be interesting to maybe have this conversation in a few months. And Indy would like to say something with regards to this question in high school. Indy, go ahead.
Sorry, no, not a panelist, but just, I've taken one online course so far. I took a summer course. And obviously there are going to be new barriers about cheating and plagiarism and all these things that we're going to have to figure out how to deal with. But personally, I thought a bigger issue was just the distraction factor of being online. And now in high school, I think the majority of people are returning to school, but for people who remain online or for university, for some students who are maybe a little bit less intrinsically motivated to pay attention and be involved and be motivated, being in a physical classroom can be really, really helpful for some people to stay focused. And being online, when you just have to check in like at certain points throughout the day, it's just so much easier to not be held accountable to do that work. And to have a split screen, you basically just need your face on the screen to get those participation marks. So I worry more about students who find it helpful to have that classroom structure and have those other people and those certain times to do their work in the more loose, kind of self-motivated realm of online learning. So that's kind of a worry I have a little bit more than the actual act of cheating. Is just the academic accountability and keeping students motivated. So that was just something I wanted to add. I thought was pertinent.
Thank you, Indy. I think Hina wanted to speak quickly to this as well.
Yeah, I just remember, again, like, from the perspective of a faculty or, like, an instructor, yeah, that did kind of come up, but, I mean, one of the things that I sort of was, I'm inclined to do more, like, feel like more instructors should be doing, too, is just, there was, like, this concern about cheating, but then there was also this concern about, like, how disruptive, like, the lockdown was to students, right, in the sense, like, especially, like, university students, but, I mean, all students globally, right, is that, yes, like, there's a concern for cheating, but I feel like the conversation should center a little bit more on like support for students and being like understanding, right? Because, you know, if there's students who you have literally like no idea what people are going through. And so like, yes, the concern is cheating, but at the same time, like folks, I feel like the people who are cheating, like it's so few, like to be honest, like I feel like a lot of the people in the classroom are just folks who just want to learn and they're trying to do their best in this unprecedented situation, right? And so like I mean one of the ways in which it was sort of like I think there was just more inclination to be like, well, just try and be understanding, and then when it came to things like cheating, like I think what sort of becomes off the table now is things like on online quizzes and online tests and things like that, or like timed exams or like there was a lot of kerfuffle like from the instructor side about how to sort of deal with that as well, like how do you sort of avoid cheating. But I feel like a lot of, I don't know, I get a little uncomfortable when some of the, like, obviously we need to talk about it. You need to like prevent people from cheating. But then at the same time, like, I think the bigger issue at hand here is like how disruptive this has been to student learning. And, I mean, we were sort of told also because this is so unprecedented and you need to be a little bit more understanding of, like, especially when it came to like students and the quality of work that could be done when there is no access to the physical library. The university doesn't have, you know, and public libraries locally, like, don't have access to physical books. Like, they don't have access to all these online print materials. So then how are you supposed to write a high quality research essay without any access to a library, right? Or like proper access to campus materials, like learning materials. So it's like, I think sometimes the accusation of, oh, like, people are going too easy on students, but how are students supposed to learn when they can't have access to those materials they need, right? So that's just my little piece about that.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's like, it is kind of assuming, the cheating question is kind of assuming that, or not just cheating, but in general, is assuming that all students are on the same playing field. And I don't think that's the case. People are really, really struggling. And some people love it. Some people, it's working out really well for them. And I will say that, it's too bad that the best well-meaning people often get hurt the most because, you know, when profs say close book, but you can fully open your book because there's no one there to check, the people who actually keep their books closed are going to get lower marks than people who just do open book. So that kind of sucks. I don't know how they're going to do that. I hope they change the format. Okay. One last question was about deferring, and about opting out, and also one about small groups and learning. Okay, I'm gonna read this from Ali again. Sequoia and Audney, I asked this before. Okay, sorry. Do you have an idea of how many folks you know / are friends with who are opting out of going back to school or are deferring? I know it's happening. I'd just be curious if you have any insight into how pervasive this is, even just in your circles. Yes. That is, it's hard for me. I don't know too much about the entering class. I think for big schools like McGill and U of T that just pump a bunch of students through, I don't know if that will be a huge issue because people are just gonna apply. But I wonder for smaller schools and also for programs that are really like in person too, I wonder if they've seen a drop in deferring. Let's see, I'm trying to think of any friends. See, for a lot of my friends, they would want to defer, but they actually can't because of loans that they're on and scholarships. Like, you will lose your scholarship if you defer. So a lot of people are kind of locked in like that. They make it quite hard to take a year off in the middle of your studies. It's not super easy to do. It's much easier to defer as an entering student. I know a lot of people actually are deferring just to work for a bit. But Yeah, I don't, I'm not sure. I don't super know too much.
Yeah, well, I do know my friend is planning to go to Laurier Brantford, but they are, she has some issues with a course that she's taking, and they're like, it's okay, most of your courses are still open, like your program's still open, because a lot of people have deferred. I know with Mohawk College, they canceled it the entire semester, so a lot of people don't even have anything until January. So they, a lot of people who apply to Mohawk are left with absolutely nothing, especially some people who took a year off in the middle of, like, they were in, I know someone who is in university and they dropped out because they want to do something concerning music, a more hands-on program, which was at Mohawk. And they applied there, they got in, and then last minute, they said, okay, now you can't go there. You have until January. So that's also that. So I know another person who just did their 13th year or their 12 plus, and they are deferring again because they also don't want to go. They don't know how online learning is going to be. So I know a lot of people who are actually deferring, and the programs are not being as, they're not filled up. Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I wonder. I'll be curious to see, like, once they release the enrollment stats. I wanted to add one thing quickly. I think Hina said something in the chat about reevaluating the traditional ways of examining people and testing them. And from my perspective, McGill is an extremely academics-focused school, so it kind of, like, prepares you for grad school. A lot of essay writing, a lot of, like, memorize this, spit it out in the midterm, it's worth 50%, good luck, you know? So it's less, like, it's less communal, it's more individual, which is something I don't really like about it. So yeah, I do wonder, someone also mentioned that open book exams are more challenging than closed book exams. I agree with that. You really have to know your stuff if it's open book. So I do wonder if McGill and other very traditional schools will change the way that they do it.
That's it. That's all for today. Thanks to our guests, and we look forward to hearing back about your experiences this fall. Special thanks, as always, to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Ault, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gevert, Hina Mystery, and Sequoia Kim, who you heard from today, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us in one of our live Zoom sessions, or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. Thank you for listening.